Okay, questions? Any topic? There will be a homework that will be posted this afternoon. It will have three or four problems. It may have only three. I hope you won't be disappointed. But it might have four. The fourth would be tricky. And it will deal with regression. Yes, Karen. The interpretation of the rank sum test. It has a p-value of 0.0518. That is, as it turns out, not less than 0.05. So we would say with 95% confidence, we cannot say there is a difference in the distributions here. Now, if I wanted to give a measure of the difference between the two, I wanted to quantify this in some way that you could potentially understand as a scientist. So can I put this into scientific speak? And in this case, I would say, yes, my estimate is that if I were to randomly choose a male, then there is a 60% probability that that male's measurement was higher than a randomly chosen female. How many of you think that that has now helped you understand all of the science regarding bilirubin and sex in primary biliary cirrhosis? So this is my complaint. You will find textbooks that will tell you that we can interpret this as a test of the median. That's a lie. Okay? That's not true. Not if you're thinking it's a distribution-free test. So if you're going here because you're saying, you know, I just don't think we can trust that the distribution of this data follows any particular assumption, so I want to go to a non-parametric test. Then we have to interpret this in a non-parametric sense, and there is no useful statistic that you can do this. I can show you distributions that you get statistically significant differences by the Wilcoxon that suggest that males tend to be higher than females. And then I do a test of the medians, and it will correctly out the fact that the median measurement for males is lower than the median measurement for females. So it is not a test of the medians. It is not a test of the means. I can play the same game. So my, you know, your first question was, is how do you interpret it? And I was going to start off with, well, I try not to. I say there's a difference in the distributions, and that's all you know. You can't even be certain it's a difference in the location of the distributions. If one distribution is more prone to have heavier tails than the other one, you will have a greater than 5% chance that the Wilcoxon test will become significant. So I got asked, Brian, you were the one who asked me after class about, well, what about permutation tests, you know? And my immediate answer was, yeah, I don't like permutation tests either because of this same thing. They're testing what I call the strong null hypothesis that there is no difference between the groups whatsoever. Almost always we suspect that there's probably a difference somewhere. It's just maybe not one we care about. So this is what makes the Wilcoxon test very difficult to explain. Now, when we get what I'm about to go into is in survival analysis, we'll sometimes see people use the Wilcoxon test in survival analysis. And it's a modification of it. And it's and there we interpret it as a weighted hazard ratio. Now, just quick, how many people are pleased that we've been talking about hazard ratios? Okay, that's my opinion too. And so now I'm saying, In the survival world, I can sometimes tell you when I'm using the Wilcoxon test what it is that I'm looking for. But I can't swear that that's where the difference is, but I can just say it's more likely to be significant in that case. And that's when we have early differences in survival. Okay? There's an economic policy, right? You know, economists. Anybody in here in health services that does health economics or anything like that? Or am I free to go ahead and give up? Well, I can. Am I still free to go ahead and make fun of it? No, I'm just going to make fun of economics, you know, which is actually, you know, as I go field to field to field, my true interest now is to study evolutionary economics. But I will note that there is a Nobel Prize in economics and not a Nobel Prize in statistics, precisely because the economists never have to test their hypotheses. They just get to propose them and say it's there. And, you know, we unfortunately, you know, if I say something about I think this treatment works, you know, we test it and it doesn't. So it's this concept, though, that I borrow from economics that says in economics there's only two time frames that are of interest, is the long run and the short run. And in the long run, we're all dead. Well, this is the concept that we get into survival as we talk about the log rank test or the Wilcoxon test or some of the other things that we might think about. Is people will say, you know, every treatment doesn't affect things for everybody in a certain way. How does it affect that? For instance, what is the benefit of, say, surgery for, surgery for most conditions. Let's take bone marrow transplant. I guess that doesn't have to be so much surgery. But what's the benefit of bone marrow transplantation on survival in leukemia? We'll even go where it's easy to answer. What happens when you do bone marrow transplantation on patients who are, I'm going to give you a good setting, people who are in remission from leukemia? Good idea to do or bad idea to do? How many of you work at the hutch? Yeah, okay. So good idea or bad idea?
Depends why I ask the question. So short-term survival would be reduced. You may not survive the treatment, but if they survive the treatment,
so that's exactly the point. To say, so we so quickly get to the thing that we talk about in survival all the time is saying, those survival curves that separate, where do they separate? Do they separate right after the start of the study and then come back together, like that pathologic example I showed you? Or are they similar for a while and then they start separating? Or, in the worst case, do they cross each other? Then at first, those people who are undergoing bone marrow transplantation, you wipe out their defense system. A certain number of them die of infections that if you just left them alone for 60 days, they'd probably all been alive. But then go a year out, and those people that you left alone may have relapsed, whereas the people that you gave bone marrow transplantation, those who survived, did process, are now doing well. So in the survival world, we will look for early differences in survival, late differences in survival, middle differences in survival. And it turns out that the Wilcoxon test in that setting is one that is more sensitive to differences that occur early and less sensitive to differences that occur late. The log rank test, depending upon who you talk to when, people either say it applies equal weights across the whole time of the study, or if you talk to me, it says it still puts a little bit more weight earlier rather than late, and we have other statistics that will put a lot of emphasis late. So there's a whole class of statistics that we can say, how do you look at that? So in that instance, I really, you know, when I get statistical significance on the Wilcoxon test, I can't immediately say, there, you have early differences in survival. But instead, when you come to me and say, here's what I think it looks like, I can say, you're more likely to get significant results with the Wilcoxon or less likely to get differences with the Wilcoxon according to whether you drew the picture that said showed we had an early benefit or not. In some tests, this was a thing in the National Lung Screening Trial, which was a clinical trial, 55,000 people. Half were randomized to get just regular chest x-rays. Half were randomized to get spiral CT. And the fear was, actually, that we would pick up so many more things on the spiral CT. And because we hadn't been screening them regularly, we were picking it up late before we could do something with it. So they wanted to sort of downweight the deaths that occurred early in this clinical trial because it wasn't relevant to the idea of what would happen if we were steady state. What if we had been screening everybody for 20 years? Now is it good? And so they said, in this instance, we would expect the early differences to maybe even not be beneficial for the spiral CT because you diagnosed somebody and you were better off leaving them alone than sending them to surgery. But then later, after we were only picking up the very early cancers, now maybe it was better to send them to surgery and that we do that. So they chose test statistics to try to downweight those early times. So in the survival world, we do that. Well, why can we do this in the Wilcoxon test? Well, the Wilcoxon test compares distribution on the probability that Y is greater than X. And in the presence of censoring, we can do this. This is a general type of statistics. We can do this for lots of different things. When we talk about the general type of statistic, we define it by a very descriptive term. We call it a U statistic. Okay. And in fact, when the Wilcoxon statistic was defined by Mann and Whitney, they used the letter U for it. And so it was the Mann-Whitney U statistic and where the name is. But when people talk about a U statistic, they talk about taking something where you just take two people and you can tell which one you like better. You know, which number is better than the other. That's all you have to decide. And then you take every possible pair of them and you say, which one do I like better? Well, in the censoring world, if both measurements are uncensored, I know I like the person who lived longer than the person that died. Or if I'm deaf, maybe I like the person who died. Person who lived longer. But this idea is I know which treatment I prefer on this basis would be the one that has the uncensored Y tending to be greater than the uncensored X. Now, if I have a censored observation of Y, but an uncensored observation of X, and Y is greater than X, sure, I don't know what Y really was, but I know that it's longer than that. So you know that I have, in fact, lived longer than everybody who died at age 13. You don't know whether I have lived longer than the people who died at age 80 or whether I will. Okay. So which one can we resolve? Well, we can resolve that I'm better off than the people who died at 13. But it's unknown in this example. I am still alive. You know somebody else died at age 80. Who lives longer, me or the other person? You don't know. So you just say, I can't tell which is best. We'll give that a zero. So we'll have ones. We'll have negative ones. Give that one a zero. And if both of them are censored, you also have no idea. So what we do is we do just like the rank test, just like the Mann-Whitney U formation, but we just put some zeros in there. We sort of regard them as ties. Peter.
But if someone was censored at 20 years and one person was censored at 30 years, wouldn't a 30-year-old be better off? So you wouldn't.
Okay, so how old are you and how old am I? Who's better off between us?
Well, what if we were both dead?
What? Oh, if we were both dead, we'd be uncensored.
Okay.
So, but right now, we're both censored. We don't know when neither of us died.
Okay.
We don't know when neither of us died. Yeah, see, I turned this on you, and you had no idea. Yeah, if you're better, you or me, that was an easy one for you to answer. But, you know, just... So, This is asymptotically normally distributed. The standard errors can be computed from permutation distributions to test the equality of the entire distribution. We can also put this in the context of the Kaplan-Meier estimates and the hazards that we estimate, and so we can actually use weighted forms, basically of Greenwood's formula to get this. But again, we usually do it under the null distribution, assuming there's equality of the whole distribution. So when we do this, just like with the log rank statistic, we tend to do this from test a strong null. So it can be viewed as a weighted log rank statistic. It's a weighted average of the difference in hazards, placing greater weight on differences in the survival curve that appear early. There are lots of ways to weight log rank statistics. If the hazard ratio is constant over time, the unweighted log rank statistic is the best thing to use. But just realize that even with the log rank statistic, you still tend to place more importance where you have more data. So you can put an acceptable amount, you know, make it approximately equal to the number that you have at risk, or you could put even more weight up there. The Wilcoxon places even more weight. But recall, again, my pathologic example of where the hazard ratio estimated the opposite direction from what the curves imply. That was because I managed to get the number at risk high later in the study rather than at the earliest times. You can get this in Stata from STS test by saying Wilcoxon. The default is log rank, so when you don't type anything, it does the log rank test. If you type Wilcoxon, it will give you the censored form of the Wilcoxon test. And as a general rule, you don't go fishing around for is the log rank statistic, is the significant, is the Wilcoxon significant, maybe I should use a different weighting. You choose in advance which weighting you want to use and justify that you only want to look for the early differences or that you want to look for differences that would occur throughout. The question I'd have for you is, what are the reasons that you would only want to look for early differences? Scientific reasons. Well, how do we choose a functional to compare? Again, say, what's scientifically important? When is it most important to find a treatment that has a benefit early as opposed to one that still has a benefit late? I have trouble thinking of them. So then the next one is, what is plausible? What do you think your treatment is doing? And that's most of the time that we would use the Wilcoxon form of the log rank and survival analysis, is when we're imagining that the treatment's effect will only be for a short period of time. Okay, so far we have been primarily talking about cases where all of our data was independent. We did talk about the paired t-test, but we talked about it as when we would collapse the data and then do a one-sample test. Here, I just want to talk a little bit about when we have dependent data within clusters and then look at a couple of tests that we can do when we have matched continuous data. So dependent data within clusters. Times that the data cannot be presumed to be totally independent because we're sampling within families. We're sampling within schools and hospitals. We have repeated measurements on individuals that are taken out at a single time, or we have repeated measurements taken on individuals over time. In biomedicine, we will have repeat biopsies that are taken on an individual at different time, at the same time that we might want to have this done. We might have something like blood pressure measurements that you're taking on each arm or on your arm and your leg to look for peripheral vascular disease. In the social sciences, they deal with this problem a whole lot because they'll give you different batteries of tests all at the same time. And so that they this what we call this repeated measures. When most people talk about repeated measures, those words are repeated measurements made at the same time. And then we tend to use the word longitudinal data when they're repeated measurements made on an individual over time. But really, statistically, it's the same issue. Why do you have longitudinal data? Well, I have divided all the reasons why you might have longitudinal data into three cases. So you can imagine that there really are only three cases. Well, no, but it's the basic idea. So perhaps you have it just because it's easy to do. Perhaps you're doing it because it gives you more precision. And perhaps you're doing it because that's the only way you can answer your question. So whenever somebody hands me longitudinal data or repeated measurement data, something that's correlated, I do always try to figure out, did it have to be this way? And then I usually add the phrase, or are you just trying to make my job harder? So we do have to do extra things when we have correlated data. So for convenience, our questions are truly cross-sectional, that we're trying to answer a question about the population, but it's easier to make multiple measurements on each individual than it is to find new people to make measurements on. This only works if there is natural variation within the people. So I take an example of, imagine I am trying to look at serum osmolality, so the whole concentration of all solutes in the blood, right? This affects, for instance, whether you get swelling in your other tissues is according to how much you have stuff in your blood vessels that keep the water there. So you're wanting to look at this. It's not an easy thing to measure. So we usually don't measure it. Instead, we estimate serum osmolality. But the first time you figure out how to estimate serum osmolality, you got to get a training sample, measure it on everybody, and you find this rule. Now, as I'm trying to figure that out, really all I need is a sample of a whole bunch of bloods with different osmolalities and different measures of the chemicals that I'm going to use. In this case, I said sodium, glucose, and blood urea nitrogen. So I'm going to estimate it from these three values. In order to come up with a rule that does well, all I need is a bunch of samples that have different values of sodium, glucose, and BUN, and different values of osmolality. It really doesn't matter whether it's the same person or not for my question. I'm going to use this same thing on everybody. But when people go to a hospital, there are those people who you take a zillion measurements on all through the day just because you're cruel and you want to poke them with needles. And then there are those that you take very few blood draws on because they're small babies and you don't want to bleed them to death. You know, so we'll have different numbers of measurements on the different people, but why not just use all of them that are available? So pure convenience. But if you gave me all independent data, I could still answer my question. On efficiency, we could have questions that could be answered with a cross-sectional study, but if we make measurements within subjects, we might have less variability. This will allow detection of smaller effects. So, as we've been talking with the project and talking in discussion section at different times about what we do with baseline values, well, it seems reasonable that if you had everybody's baseline value and you looked at the change in their measurements, that might be beneficial. For instance, really big case in the audiology data set. Some people come in with pretty good hearing. Some people are old and are already deaf at the higher frequencies. And if you just randomize people there, you have to deal with this huge variation of people who already have 60 decibel hearing loss at the high frequencies and some people that are at zero. wouldn't it be nicer as you're looking for a difference to compare the people who started out at 60 and lost 10 decibels to themselves, and the people who started out at zero and lost 10 decibels to themselves, and not have to deal with that huge variability. So while I could answer the question without having any baseline values, I'll get way more precision if I do have the baseline values. Similarly, I'm trying to figure out which does better for you in terms of lowering your blood pressure, transcendental meditation, or exercise. I could randomize the whole population and look at a population of people who only did exercise and a population of people who only did transcendental meditation. But perhaps I'll get more precision if I take people who, half of them, I make them first do transcendental meditation for a few months, and then I make them stop, and then make them do exercise for a few months. Or those others that I start off on exercise and then make them do transcendental meditation. And I pretend that there is no carryover, that once you've done transcendental meditation, there is no element of you continuing to do it after I tell you to do exercise, and vice versa. After you've started on exercise and gotten used to it, you revert easily to just sitting around and doing transcendental meditation. So, but if I could do that, I would have therefore adjusted for essentially the baseline risk factors that people had for hypertension, and I would be able to get more precision as I answered my question. Example, percent glycosylated hemoglobin, or if you're in England, glycated hemoglobin. I don't think that's caught on here, has it? Used to monitor long-term control of diabetes, hemoglobin A1C. We could consider studies of two insulin delivery strategies, either as independent groups or as a crossover design. And in this graph, if there's independent samples, this might be a scatter plot, jittered, of course, of the hemoglobin A1C for the control and treatment. And as you look at this data, you might be impressed with the fact that there doesn't appear to be huge differences between these two groups, these two means. And in fact, the p-value is 0.093. So not able to demonstrate that there's a difference. But if these were not, the large between subject variability hampers ability to detect differences, because our standard error of x bar minus y bar is just the variance in the X group divided by its sample size, plus the variance in the Y group divided by its sample size. But if we had done a crossover study where I've now drawn lines connecting the measurements made on the same individual, and of course I've made up this data, but we see the preponderance of those lines go down. And now we're able to get that information saying, you know what, these differences show an improvement. Now, with the exact same marginal distribution, so the numbers on each treatment that were made were the exact same, but because it makes sense to match those measurements with each other, I now have a p-value of 0.002. And the reason that that works is because now my standard error is the variance within the X group plus the variance in the Y group minus 2 times the correlation times the standard deviations. So that's a smaller variation. Whereas in my previous study, where it was independent groups, what was the correlation? Well, 0. But now by having matched observations, I now have correlated observations. And so that makes for a smaller standard error. So this is a case where I get the same scientific value having independent groups, but I get way more precision by being able to make measurements in the same subjects. Sometimes you can't do this. Sometimes your measurement process is destructive testing. So as you wanted measurements over time, that in order to sample anything, You can't make another measurement. In biomedicine, this shows up in laboratory studies sometimes when you're doing animal experiments and you're doing necropsy to measure what you need. You have to design an experiment where you randomize 30 animals, and every 5 days you randomly choose some animals to sacrifice and measure. We can answer that question. We would have had more precision if we could have answered it by making the measurement in the same animal over time, but we couldn't do that. But then there are the truly longitudinal questions, scientific questions about effects that occur over time, studies to detect population trends and response. Maybe you want the rate or slope of progression in a population of diabetics over time, time to development of albuminuria, and I want to make that measurement of the slope or the rate of change in each individual and then be able to compare it. We refer to these differences as marginal effects or individual effects. So, for instance, taking the hemoglobin A1C example again, and now I have measurements at baseline 1 year, 2 years, and 3 years. If I had made those measurements in different people, all I could do is compare these values. So I've made measurements in a bunch of people who were diagnosed today and a whole bunch of people who were diagnosed exactly 1 year ago, another 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Okay, we do that experiment observationally sometimes. You know, this is all the data that we have. And I get a measurement like this. And I could talk about what the average is of a population of people, but I can't tell you what's happening to the individuals in that group. You know, this is where, as we talked about the FEV data set, how I always tried to watch myself, which I wasn't always successful in, but I certainly did watch you, and I was, you know, overly pedantic when I would do that. But if you said, oh, that as people get older, they grow, or as people get older, they have larger FEV, and my answer is, no, there's nothing in data that doesn't tell you that these people who are now 12 years old weren't born being 5'6". And it just so happened that it's just the people born more recently are all small, you know. Well, you know, that's the thing. We can't answer the questions that these people who were diagnosed a year ago, are they different because they've had diabetes for a year, or are they different because they were in the cohort a year ago and something else happened in the environment? We can't answer that question. But our interest usually is to look within subjects. Usually we want to know, to be able to say we understand what's happening over time. Trends in specific individuals might not look like trends in the population means. Response over time may be restricted to subgroups of subjects, or response over time may be transient. There can be a zillion other things going on as well. So in these longitudinal scientific questions, the studies to detect time trends or covariate effects have to be made in the same subjects. We could look at distribution of rates of progression in the population over time, where we're looking at for each individual what's their rate of progression, and then maybe we'd be wanting to average those slopes of progression. We can also look at the effect of varying risk factors within individuals. What happens to you when you are smoking? What happens to you when you are not smoking? Not what's the difference between smokers and non-smokers. Here's just a case that if I did say, oh, if I had longitudinal data, a pattern like this could have led to that first data that we saw. So again, all the numbers are the same. If you look at all of these three plots I'll show you, the points within each group are the exact same. But in this case, as we looked within individuals and estimated slopes, we would find that on average there was a downward slope, but it came because 50% of the people had a large downward slope and 50% of the people had a zero slope. I said the treatment really only works in half the population. But I'd only find out that that was the case by having those measurements on that population. But that same data could have arisen because of transient effects that occurred at different times. So because I could make up this data, I can tell you what the mechanism is here, is that one-third of the population has a transient decrease at year one. One-third of the population has a transient decrease at year two. And again, relying on the fact that I made up this data so I know what it would have shown at year four, one-third of the population had a transient decrease at year three. If I'd gone out to year four, I would have seen that all of them were back up just like they were at baseline. But the key point is, without having the repeat measurements on the individuals, you could not tell which of these mechanisms led to this data. And there's a zillion more mechanisms that could have led to this data. So this then raises the question that you always have to address. So we've had enough trouble deciding whether you want to analyze the mean or the geometric mean or the median or the proportion above some threshold, the odds above some threshold, the hazards, whatever. But now we've got time in there as well. So now it gets more complicated. So now we get to choose our measures of outcome, not only in terms of the mean, but now we say the mean changes over time how, or the geometric mean, or the geometric mean changes over time how. And we've got to figure all those things. And again, in order of importance, you first consider the scientific relevance, including the state of current knowledge. It may well be that the scientific relevance of something is, let's just show that there's something going on in the population and not worry too much about the individual effects, and then later tease out the individual effects. Or it could be that you're saying that we are now ready to go ahead and tease out the individual effects. And the scientific relevance, the example I use is there are some measures that the true scientific relevance is, you know, what's your blood pressure now? Not how fast did it fall, get there. But in certain diseases, or I should say medical conditions, well, I'll go back to this as a disease, right? So you can be looking at in serum potassium, right? If your potassium's too low, that's not good for your heart. If it's too high, that's not good for your heart either. I mean, we use potassium and the balance between potassium and sodium in our body for nerve conduction and muscle contraction. That's how we maintain our electrical state, is balance between sodium and potassium. Potassium is supposed to be largely inside your cells. Sodium is supposed to be largely outside of your cells. And when they come out of whack, then you're in trouble. But if you find somebody who's low in potassium, you can raise them back to the normal level too fast. And that's bad. You know, you got to have that. Similarly, in pregnancy, I went to medical school in Virginia where preeclampsia and eclampsia is not that rare. I understand that up in New England, you know, this would make grand rounds if you saw that. But in the South, it wasn't that rare. But in that, one of the things you look for is pregnant women gain weight. But it's less important exactly what weight they're at is the fact that they gained a pound in the last week. That worries you. You know, so again, it's that change that you have to do. So the scientific concept is not what weight are they at, but how fast have they gotten there. You choose a measure that was, we're looking for the change in weight more than we're looking at that value that it's at. Then, of course, if you have several measures that are scientifically relevant, look for the plausibility that it would change that. And then lastly, do you consider the statistical precision? Only if you have several different measures that are equally scientifically relevant, equally plausible, then choose the one that's most precisely estimated. So longitudinal outcome measures, response at a fixed time, responses at multiple fixed times, an average response over time, also called an area under the curve, although in pharmacokinetics, they quite precisely define the area under the curve in their studies, and I've had pharmacokineticists come in and say, this is an area under the curve because you're taking it over a year, and we do it in just a few hours. It's still area under the curve. It's an average, time average. The rate of change in response looking at the slope, you could look at the time to attaining some particular threshold of response. These are all different ways of dealing with longitudinal data. You choose the one that seems most relevant. And of course, there's nothing to say that you couldn't take the median of all the responses over time, the minimum, the maximum. Anything that you think of you could do with a sample, you could do on all of those measurements. Does it make sense to you? Of course, if you're going to take the minimum or the maximum, you better have equal sample sizes. You better have a good sampling scheme that makes you understand that there's not bias in why you're making the measurements. You know, I have more measurements on you precisely because it started going down. Well, that scares statisticians because there's bias coming in there. You know, what we want to do is you have a set routine for why you're making the measurements, not making measurements in response to what they are. So the marginal or the population effects, marginal is the statistical term for it because it's the, you know, think back to the 2x2 table and the margins of the table. That's really all we're talking about. So it's the difference or ratio of group means, geometric means, medians, proportional odds, above threshold, hazards, so on. I put down the Wilcoxon one there just because it's you could. Or we could have the within subject effects, the mean difference or the median difference, the mean, the geometric mean or median ratio, the within subject odds ratios. Or again, we can define this. So each of these things can be defined on either the population level or the individual level. We did that on the homework where I asked you to look at the ratio of the means or the mean of the ratios. Right? You get different answers. So you want your longitudinal outcome to reflect scientific relevance, plausibility of effect, and precision. The final level of response may be more important than earlier effects. That's what we've been invoking, or I've been invoking in these prevention studies that we've done for a very short period of time relative to the eventual period of time we'd be interested in. Summarizing the response at multiple time points can reflect population rather than individuals. So we can look at the concept of where we would lose measurements on people. The idea of picking out relationships. You know, for instance, if you were to look at estrogen levels, well, estrogen, let's go with testosterone levels. Testosterone levels by age in a general population. What happens to those? And you might find that, I never thought of doing this, but in my thing here, what might you find surprisingly if you just looked at testosterone levels by age? Of what happens with age is all the men. Of course, within men, the testosterone levels go down. But the proportion of women goes up. Okay. So you have to think. I guess both of those would lead to lower levels overall. So you'd have to think about that portion of it that was describing what was happening within the individuals, men and women. I don't know what women's testosterone levels does with age. I do know with men it tends to go down. Average response over time can be sensitive to transient effects that you don't care about. On the other hand, maybe you do care about the transient effects and you want to make certain you find them. So that's a scientific decision. Differences in time to event may be clinically meaningless. So I want to measure the time until you die, but if you're going to die from this procedure, it's going to be in the first 5 days. Well, really, I just care about how many people survive that 5 days. I don't care about the fact that I kept some people alive for 2 days and other people alive for 3 days. I want to know how many people have survived a long period of time. So lots and lots of science goes into this. And again, if you ask your average statistician, they will almost always tell you, use all of the data, then you're going to have more precision. But it always should be, only use all of your data and get that precision if you're still answering the same scientific question. Repeated measurements on subjects require special analysis techniques. If you fail to account for correlated observations, then your point estimates may be biased for population parameters. Too much emphasis is placed on some subjects. Of course, how much emphasis should be placed on some subjects is a scientific question of its own, right? The difference between the question of, at my house, what is the favorite kind of ice cream? You would get different answers if you polled the inhabitants of the house, as if you counted the amount of ice cream that was bought. Okay? So which is important? You know, again, you have to decide what that emphasis is. I don't maintain this bulk on nothing. So it's ice cream. Confidence intervals will not be accurate representation of our true confidence, and p-values will be wrong. There are three basic approaches to analyzing correlated data. The easiest one, reduce measurements on each cluster to a single observation and then analyze across the clusters. Another is to estimate correlation within the clusters and adjust the standard errors for population bias models. This is GEE, is a term you'll see, generalized estimating equations. This is the, probably when most people say marginal models, they mean something that falls in this general category. And using robust variance estimates. So when I tell you that, oh, in linear regression, we'll use robust, that's what we're doing here. Then the other thing is adjust estimates for random effects. One statistician's mean is another statistician's variance. In the random effects model, we are adjusting for the correlation by trying to adjust for personal means or cluster means. In the marginal models, we're just saying we don't want to change the means. We don't want to have it as within individual effects. We don't want to say, holding the individual constant, this is what you get. You want to say, just in the population, what's there, but let me handle the variance. Let me handle this correlation as a variance. So the GEE models, the marginal models, handle the correlation as a covariance, as a variance. The random effects handle the correlation by modeling the mean appropriately. We'll continue here on Monday.